We're glad to have you with us at the Westside Conservative. You're the guy they're here to hear.
Thank you,
Welcome to Westside Conservative.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you, Kim. I thought I'd first just give you a quick Bush family update, because people in Iowa are always asking about George and Barbara, for starters, because of their longstanding connection to this incredible state. When I was a young whippersnapper, I was in 1979, I think I went to 75 of the 99 counties. Watch out. It's a dog-eat-dog world here. So I got to see Iowa firsthand, and my dad campaigned and was successful here. They're doing great. My dad is 91 years old. They celebrated 10 days ago their 71st anniversary, and as my dad told Mom when they woke up in the morning, "Barbara, it doesn't feel like a day over 70 that we've been married." So he's frail, but his spirit is great and his mind is great, and my mother is the best caregiver in the world. And George W. and Laura are doing well as well. I love my family very much. I apologize for those that have a hard time understanding that, but if you have a great family, you should appreciate it. And I got to tell you one other thing about my family. I have a granddaughter whose name is Georgia Helena Walker Bush. We call her 41 in our family because she's named after the greatest man alive, my father. Georgia, let me see if I can get this right. Georgia is a Texas-Mexican, Iraqi-Canadian-American. A quadra-hyphenated American. Her mom was born in Canada. Sandra, my daughter-in-law's parents were Iraqi. I'm Texan by birth, Floridian by choice. My wife is from Mexico, and hence this quadra-hyphenated, beautiful, precious, trilingual, brilliant little four-year-old. And when she fills out the form, when she turns 21, you know, the form, the census form, she'll say not applicable as it relates to ethnicity. And I just make that point because that's what we need to do in our country. We need to have a commonality. We're all Americans. We should stop having politicians break us up in our disparate parts. Americans are fantastic. And I watched the State of the Union address last night, and the president has this tendency, as gifted as he is, and he had regret about the divide in our country. My goodness. Think about it. Every time he's had a chance, he pushes down people that disagree with him to make his view look more sophisticated and important. And he always has the straw man argument. So if you're against the Iranian agreement, you're a warmonger. You're in cahoots with the Death to America crowd. When in fact, the person that is more in cahoots with the Death to America crowd is the person who's legitimized the regime that continues to hold four Americans hostage, that continues to destabilize the region, that continues now soon with $100 billion-plus dollars of resources to take their agenda into the region to win their battle, their Shia battle over the Sunnis, that violates sanctions by testing medium-range missiles that will directly threat our strongest ally in the region, Israel. We need a president that will try to find common ground with people and forge consensus and stand on principle, but never just as the first impulse divide us. The front-running candidate for the Republican nomination has this same tendency. He does. He disparages people with disabilities. Really? Really? I don't know about you, but that bothers me deeply, that people with disabilities who are a gift from God, who have the same value that we do, that all of us do, are disparaged by the front-running candidate for him to make himself look better and bigger. America is better than that. America is the most extraordinary country in the world. We have to apply our conservative principles in a hopeful, optimistic way. And that's what I got to do when I was governor of the state of Florida, and that's why I've laid out the most detailed plans to take conservative principles that all of us in this room believe in to make our country move up again. When I was governor, we cut taxes every year totaling $19 billion. We don't have an income tax for those that may have forgotten. It's kind of hard to get to $19 billion over 8 years. But I live by the principle that people's income needed to grow faster than government's income. We grew our economy by 4.4% per year during my 8 years. Government grew by half of that. In Florida, you can fire a government worker for incompetency. I know that sounds like a radical idea. I apologize. I don't want to sound radical, but that actually happened. And it earned me thousands of labor organizers that came into the state to try to take me out in my reelection campaign. But it was the right thing to do. So in an era where we led the nation in job growth, 1.3 million jobs that were created, we reduced the government workforce by 11%, by 13,000 people. We were the state that created the first voucher program in the country statewide, and the second statewide voucher program, and the third. Because I took on very powerful interests, not because, you know, I wanted to have a food fight, but because it is wrong to trap people in failing schools. Kids should not be in failing schools. Parents should be empowered to make choices for their children. And if we did that across the country, we would have rising student achievement. We would lead the world for the next generation because children would be college and or career ready. They're not today. It is shameful because the liberals are protecting the economic interests of the adults in these systems. I'm the guy that took on the powerful interests, and I won. And Florida was at the bottom of the pack, but because of that kind of leadership, we've had the greatest gains of learning across the board. I'm proud of being a conservative. I want to evangelize about the conservative message. I want to take this to every nook and cranny of every part of our country. I'm not going to be a candidate or a president that disparages people. I want to unite around conservative principles so that everybody has a chance to pursue their dreams as they see fit. The final thing I want to say is that I believe, and this is an organizing principle of my life, and I hope it is for yours as well, I believe that life is a gift from God, that it is divinely inspired, that we're here for a purpose. We're not just organisms kind of interacting amongst ourselves like plankton or something like that. That this is divinely inspired. And if you believe like I do that that's the case, then the mission for the conservative cause is to make sure that people reach their God-given abilities, whatever they are, and that they pursue their dreams, whatever they want them to be, and that the interaction of all of us in a free society where you have limited government, not expansive government, where you create the field of dreams, if you will, and the interaction of all of us in our own unique ways will create more prosperity, more benefits, more compassion, more love, whatever the virtues that you consider to be important than any government program ever created. That's what we are as conservatives. That is a hopeful, optimistic message. We will only win if we embrace the philosophy that we hold true in a way that inspires others to join us rather than separating us from them. That's my mission. And you all have a chance to decide and define what the conservative cause looks like. You have more power than you realize of what the conservative cause moving into 2017 looks like. Will it be a hopeful, optimistic message, the Reagan-esque message that is timeless? Or are we going to change the philosophy to be angry, to be divisive, to be disparaging? That's up to you. I know where I stand. I hope you stand with me. Thank you all very much. Yes.
So one of the problems, you talk about resources for education, one of the problems that schools in Iowa are facing is having to provide English as a second language for kids that are illegal aliens. How do you handle that?
Well, in Florida, we have a few more than you might, just to be kind of be on the record here. We have English as a second language. We changed the policies to accelerate inclusion. Instead of having 2 years, we accelerated this, and I think that's the appropriate. The faster you can get people into the mainstream classes, the better it is. Here's what I believe, because I know it to be true, because I've seen it firsthand. Children are genius until they start looking more like us. When they start being socialized and more adult-like, they start getting stupider. Kids are smarter than we give them credit for. If you have high expectations for all kids, they achieve it. So we eliminated this notion that you have to have 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years of separation of kids that are where English is a second language. And guess what? We lead the nation in the nation's report card for ESL kids because we've had the greatest learning gains because they're part of our accountability system. Every kid counts. We grade schools A, B, C, D, and F. really crazy idea, but it actually works, 100% based on student learning. And if every kid counts, then there's attention given to every child, and we've seen great gains with the ESL kids because of that. And I think it's a good thing. Now, the federal government should play a role in this. If they're not providing support for schools and communities because they're not controlling the border, then there's a responsibility of the federal government. But at the end of the day, it should not be viewed as an excuse to have a system that says, well, it's not fair to have high expectations for every child. That dooms kids. That totally dooms them. Florida proves the other way, that if you assume that every child can learn, you have high expectations for everyone, it turns out that every child can learn. And we have gone from the bottom of the pack in terms of the nation's report card, that one test, the NAEP test, to be, you know, in the top five or six in many of these categories. We've gone beyond Iowa with a student population that is 57% minority and 56 or 7% qualified for free and reduced lunch. Who would have thunk it? That's a conservative applying principles in the right way that helps people that didn't vote for me. That's how we win. That's how I won in a landslide, and I left with a 67% approval rating, by the way, as the most reform-minded conservative in the state's history. You do it because you're passionate about conservative principles and applying them the right way. Imagine if we had a president that actually thought conservatism applied the right way would work. Man, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit in Washington, D.C., I can promise you that. It's a field day for the next president if he's all in on fixing our career civil service system, on fixing our tax code, how we regulate, embracing the energy revolution. I would love to say that the 10th Amendment, say it publicly, the 10th Amendment is as powerful as the First or the Fourth or any of the Bill of Rights, because we should shift as much power back to the states, Medicaid, education programs, transportation programs, the EPA delegated authority back to the state environmental agencies. I would overturn the Waters of the United States rule. I would, as on the first day, any of the rules that haven't been finalized, I would stop them in their tracks. Because every time this president takes power away from communities, he weakens our ability to rise up. He takes away the lifeblood of our community and our country, which is a bottom-up approach rather than a top-down. And education is the place where that plays out, most particularly at the state level. And the gains that we've had in Florida are directly related to working as a team to tear down the barriers to make sure every kid is successful. I'm proud of that, to be honest with you. Yep.
How many more immigrants would come through your reforms, and can you list the benefits to citizens from that many more?
Well, I don't. My reform on immigration. My reform on immigration is to control the border, to narrow the number of people coming by family to spouse and minor children. Right now we have spouse, minor children, adult siblings, and adult parents. We have what's called chain migration. We should narrow the number of people to what every other country has, which is spouse and minor children. We should have a guest worker program in the areas where there is big labor shortages, where based on economic need. We should control the border so that illegal immigration is much harder to come to this country than legal immigration. We need an e-verify system. We need to eliminate sanctuary cities. And we need to deal with the 12 million people that are here illegally. There are some that say, well, let's just make it so harsh for them that they'll self-deport. That would be a really surgical strike. Because if you make it so harsh for them that they self-deport, you're making it harsh for everybody else. You can't just, like, if you're creating that kind of climate, that's not good for anybody. Or to say we're just going to deport, we're rounding them up, knocking on doors, rounding them up. 12 million people over 2 years, that's the Trump plan. The Trump plan would require doubling the criminal justice system, doubling it. Because we have about 500,000 people in our criminal justice system right now. If you doubled it, it would cost hundreds of billions of dollars. It's not a serious plan. The plan that I've laid out is this, a provisional work permit. You pay a fine, you pay taxes, you work. You don't receive federal government assistance. You learn English, you don't commit crimes, and over an extended period of time, you earn legal status, not a path to citizenship. That, to me, is the practical conservative approach. So the number of people coming in terms of immigrants would be controlled, and we would pick who would come in. There are more economic immigrants going into Canada, a country one-tenth our size, than the United States. We have family, the driver of legal immigration, and we have too much illegal immigration. Fixing those two things would give us a chance to turn immigration into an economic catalyst so all people benefit from it, because that's what we need to do. Yeah. Yeah, I think we need to press the pause. I'll be as specific as you want. I think we need to press the pause button on refugees coming from Syria. That until it is proven beyond a reasonable doubt that they're not embedded inside of any population, Islamic terrorists, we shouldn't allow them in. And when the director of the FBI says we don't have the capability of doing that, I don't care what the president says. That's the guy who you would ask, and he was asked, and he said it's not possible under current conditions to be able to identify people coming into our country that may not, that want to attack us, just as what happened in Paris. So I don't think we should take refugees until that's settled, and it may not ever be settled. I don't know. Secondly, we need to deal with the visa waiver program. One of the great challenges is, if you're a German citizen or many other countries in Europe, you get an expedited visa. It's good. It's good for business to have people enter, make it easy for people to come and go. But the problem is that now we have this threat of citizens from Europe that may travel to Iran or may travel to Syria or may travel to a place where radical Islam, where they can be radicalized. And there should be a second review of those cases. And the Congress agreed with that. They've passed this legislation. The president seems to be viewing this as incorrect, but I think it's appropriate. There should be a thorough review of the visa waiver program to make sure that passports aren't falsified. We need to be vigilant. This is the first responsibility of the government is to protect the homeland. And we have to do this. This is the president last night made it appear that Islamic terrorism, well, you can't call it that, for starters. That it's not an existential threat. He tried to make it sound like, well, we're not going to be invaded. Well, okay, we've never been invaded. That's really an irrelevant point. Is it a threat to us? Yes, it is. They can freeze us in place. They can attack us at our soft point, which is our very freedom. And we need to enhance the homeland security efforts. I think we need to reauthorize the Patriot Act, including the metadata program. We need to be vigilant across the board. It is a threat. And each day that it exists in the form of a caliphate, it wins. And when the president brags about containment, he misses the whole point. They want containment. They want to have this territory. They want it to be, they declare victory, and it allows them to recruit people from all around the world to be radicalized and create havoc. So we have to take out ISIS there. We have to destroy the caliphate to be successful. And that only the United States can do. Because we, not to be the world's policeman again, or to be an occupying force, but we're the only one that could forge a coalition led by Sunnis in Syria, emboldening the different varying forces in Iraq to do this. And I'm the only guy that laid out a specific detailed plan to do this prior to Paris and prior to San Bernardino. And you know where I did it? Did it at the Reagan Library, because I wanted to make the case that the proper foreign policy of this country is peace through strength. To deter aggression, we need to have the strongest military force known to man. The sequester has to be eliminated. We have to have a president that has the back of the military and the intelligence agencies to keep us safe. Yes, sir. If any policy wonks here, I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but if you are, Jeb2016.com is the place to go. We have, as it relates to the corporate rate, corporate tax, my proposal is to take the highest corporate tax rate in the industrial world, developed world, lower it to 20%, 5 points higher than China, lower than China, excuse me. Eliminate all the carve-outs and deductions, eliminate them all. And allow for full expensing of capital investing. This recovery is so weak because capital investing is at an all-time low in the modern economy. So to incent the real economy, not the financial services sector that has done extraordinarily well in the age of Obama, full expensing of capital investing, and elimination of interest expense kind of as the trade-off. That would simplify the code, and by the way, and then move to a territorial tax system rather than this worldwide tax system. So you'd have the $2 trillion of cash that would be taxed at 8.75%, allowed to be repatriated at that rate. It would create great opportunities to invest in infrastructure and to reduce the debt, and then move towards this territorial tax system, which every other country has. So you eliminate this inversion absurdity where larger U.S. companies are being bought by smaller European companies that have lower tax rates. You move the headquarters there, you lose the tax revenue for the country, and you lose jobs. We should have whatever the opposite of inversions are come into our country, and this tax code would do it. On the personal rate, I would move to simplify the code to three rates, 10, 25, and 28. And eliminate and put caps on deductions that are higher for higher-income people than lower-income people. So in return for the lower rates, you would simplify the code there. Right now, about 46 million people file the long-form tax form. In this plan, it would go down to 13 million. So you'd have a simplified code. You would raise the exemption so that people making $40,000 or less, they'd still pay the payroll tax, of course, but they wouldn't pay, a family of four wouldn't pay federal income tax. The middle class would get, on average, a $2,300 break. And high-income people would have a reduction in rate, but they would have a cap on their deductions, which they use more than the people in the middle. I would eliminate the marriage penalty and provide support for people that are at retirement age or more that are still working, that they would receive, they wouldn't have to pay the employee portion of the payroll tax. In essence, this has been viewed by the Tax Foundation, which is the conservative think tank that has looked at all of the plans, and it would, in their mind, create 1% additional growth per year in the economy, which the dynamic effect of that would jumpstart economic growth to get us closer to 4% growth rather than 2% growth, which is the so-called new normal. I think that is the better approach. It's the realistic way of doing it. It would allow American corporations to be extraordinarily competitive. We would eliminate the special treatment for private equity firms, you know, that have their business is not treated as ordinary income; it's treated as capital gains, and so it would balance out the difference between Wall Street and Main Street, which I think is important as well. Yes, sir. Got me beat by one.
We're done.
I hope I'm not.
What other than the tax code you mentioned, what else could we do to reset that? I know the legislature, Congress just threw another $2 million on top of that.
Yeah, I mean, this omnibus thing is just a disaster to wait till the last moment, the government's closing down, pile everything on a big table and pass it without knowing what it is. That's not how we operate. We gotta get back to regular order business. The president should submit a budget and fight for it. The authorization process ought to be, you know, regular order way. There ought to be a conference committee. I mean, someone needs to send the civics books that we used to have, at least, back to Washington so they get back to the business of passing real budgets that where the Congress has its oversight authority. It's a disaster what we have now. And a president needs to lead in this regard and start banging heads to get them back to do what governors do with the legislature across this country. This is not the most novel, difficult thing to do. In fact, in 240 years, we've had this dysfunction 7 years in a row, but we haven't had it regularly. This is a absurdity that hopefully will be the exception rather than rule. So how do we deal with the budget deficit? Grow at 4% rather than 2%. Exponential revenue growth if that happens. And there are things that we need to do in regulation, in taxes, embracing the energy revolution in our midst, fixing the things that are holding us back in terms of economic growth. Secondly, we need entitlement reform. You can't do this without changing Obamacare, Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security, which is not an entitlement, but it is a severely underfunded retirement plan. It is. If it was a private sector retirement plan, it would be bankrupt, as is the case with Medicare. I mean, if you all remember Mad Magazine, this, young people probably here don't remember Mad Magazine, do you? Alfred E. Newman? Alfred E. Newman, we're in Washington, it's Alfred E. Newman Economics. You know, what me worry? No big deal. I mean, if you listen to Hillary Clinton, we don't have an entitlement problem, really? I mean, the cost of this, the exponential growth of these programs far exceeds any other program. And the so-called, you know, it's an entitlement, which means you can't do anything about it. Of course you can. We have to change it. And I have detailed plans to do that. That would save hundreds of billions of dollars, by the way. That one thing is the only, if you had to pick one thing that if you were serious about reducing the debt and reducing the deficit, it's entitlement reform. And I've had the courage at least to lay out a very specific plan. And guess what? What I find in the town hall meetings is that it's well received. This whole idea that the third rail of American politics is to change these things. No, if you preserve and protect it for those that have it, which is part of our plan, to reform it in the out years is essential for our long-term success. And then the final thing I'd say is we need to have a balanced budget amendment, line item veto power, term limits. We need to use the tools that others, at least my state has, that creates a climate of limited government. And be serious about it, which means we'll need a constitutional convention because these guys in Washington aren't going to regulate themselves out of existence, I don't think. But the people want this. I mean, 80% of the people want the three things I just described. So we should take advantage of that right now in this climate to bring about meaningful reform. And in that environment, if you had career civil service reform, which I believe I can do, you would reduce the federal government workforce by attrition by just 10%. Then imagine shifting Medicaid back to the states with a Medicaid plus CPI rather than Medicaid growing at 8% per year and unleash it. You know, don't put all the requirements on it. Let states create a modern 21st century Medicaid plan. I trust Terry Branstad a lot more than I do the bureaucrats in CMS or whatever the acronym is up there, HHS. And I did this as governor. We reduced the cost of Medicaid because I was given a waiver, but imagine it even more liberated. The Department of Transportation, block grant that back. Last week, before the Kemp Forum on Poverty, I unveiled a plan to consolidate housing assistance, food stamps, and TANF money, which is the welfare support money, put it together in one lump sum, shift it back to the states, and give them the leeway to create a 21st century poverty program that lifts people out of poverty rather than creates dependency for people. Because right now, if you're born poor, you're more likely to stay poor for the rest of your life than any time in American history. And if you're born wealthy, you're likely to stay wealthy. And the sad fact is, if you're in the middle, lower middle or upper middle, you're getting squeezed. We have to change that by changing these programs. And you can do this at a lower cost and get better outcomes. So that's how you do this. You do those three big things. And look, the left will never do this. My proposal I laid out, it took about 10 seconds before all the left-wing groups started accusing me of cutting off, you know, life support for people in poverty. Really, I mean, the food stamp error rate is double-digit. Earned income tax credit, which is an effective tool if it was reformed to lift people out of poverty, has a 20% error rate because there's not, we don't go through a process of qualifying people. It's kind of done after the fact. This is not by an outside study. This is the government itself that acknowledges this. You have error rates in double digits for food stamps, housing assistance. The work requirement has kind of languished. We need someone who says, in order for people to live a life of purpose and meaning, they need to be lifted out of poverty, not stuck there. That's not a life of purpose if you're taken care of financially, but you're stuck in dependency. Our country doesn't work that way. People have a chance to be lifted up, they'll take it. We have to assume that's the case and then create programs that not just, you know, that require work and that require the kind of thing that will make it possible. Three things to be lifted out of poverty that matter. Graduating from high school with a college or career readiness capability. Marriage and work. And everything around those three basic things should be to encourage and enhance that. And right now, the welfare state in many cases, sadly, punishes marriage, penalizes work, and no one cares that kids aren't ready to go to college or get a job. And I do care. And we have to care as conservatives if we want to win. Yes. Well, you want me to go into Trump? I'm ready. I'm everybody else is in the witness protection program. I'm the only guy that wants to defend the conservative cause against a guy who's not a conservative. This will be good therapy for me. I'll go through it in a second. But it is, there's a legitimate reason why people are angry. They should be angry. It's not working. And we elected some extraordinary people to gain control of the Senate, and there's not a lot of evidence that it really matters right now. Joni Ernst is a great example. What a talented person. But you see the promises made, and the promises, they did pass, the Congress passed a repeal of Obamacare, which is good. At least it sent a signal that people were listening. But there's a lot more that needs to be done. And here's the deal. We need a Republican conservative president to make this happen. I'm not going to prey on people's angst and anger. I know why they're angry. Things aren't working. Look, 63% of Americans right now, based on a survey that I checked because it was so striking, this number, that it broke my heart, and I wanted to make sure it was real, and it is. 63% of Americans could not pay for a $500 auto repair cost. And 63% of Americans, if their child or anybody in their family was hurt and they had to go to an emergency room, couldn't pay for a $1,000 medical bill. A majority of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. It is no surprise why people are angry and have an anxious feeling about the future, because we have these huge structural challenges and no one in Washington seems to care. So I got that. But the problem is, if we elect someone who is just appealing to people's angst and their fears without any concrete plans, it'll be made worse. And here's the deal. Donald Trump is not a conservative. He's a big personality. I got that. And I guess he's entertaining. I mean, if you're the brunt of his attacks, it's not so entertaining. But it's, you know, I got my big boy pants on. It doesn't bother me a bit. And I'm the only guy taking him on because he's not a conservative. It wasn't that long ago, less than 10 years ago, he proposed a 14.5% tax on assets. I mean, name another politician that would have the gall to suggest that we should expropriate people's net worth as a solution to anything. He's not pro-Second Amendment. He had strongly held views. He now says, well, I was from New York. Well, who cares where you're from, man? The Second Amendment is as important as the First and the Tenth and all the rest of them. He's never been a consistent supporter of the Second Amendment. I got an A-plus rating from the NRA, period, over and out. Unquestionable what my views are, consistently so. His are totally questionable. He has been for a single-payer system and admires Scotland as a great place to look. It really works well in Scotland. No, it doesn't. Single-payer systems restrict care. It doesn't work. And it's extraordinarily expensive for through the government to create a health care plan. That's not a conservative approach. His foreign policy is basically, if you flatter him, he ends up saying, well, you're a great guy. I mean, Putin is really a great guy. He's an ally of the United States. He kills anybody that his apparatus does. I don't think he personally kills people, but journalists get killed. People that disagree with him are sent to the gulag. He's reestablishing kind of the Soviet-style leadership that takes away freedom. He is on the run. He invades countries and host countries. He's not an ally of the United States. We shouldn't outsource our foreign policy to say, Russia, you take care of ISIS. That's not their goal. Their goal is to prop up the brutal Assad regime. He suggests that there should be a 45% tariff, 45% tariff on all Chinese imports. Now, let's just pause for a moment and remember what history looks like when someone tries to implement something remotely close to that. It's called the Great Depression. It took away people's livelihood. It was a lost decade. There was misery in this country and around the world because of the global depression of the Smoot-Hawley tariffs. This is even greater than that. This would create a depression as well. The first people hurt are working people in this country that right now are one paycheck away from disaster. They would lose their livelihood with those increased costs. Then they'd lose their jobs. The second group that would be hurt are people that sell to China. Guess what? Agriculture would be the first to be retaliated against. Last time I was here, I talked to Governor Branstad, and he, with great pride, talked about how China had just announced that they were buying the equivalent of the entire soybean production of Iowa with a 15% premium. Is it conservative to suggest that you want to create total chaos in the economic system and then have agriculture be the first to be suffered? I mean, this is not a serious candidate. He's entertaining. But if we believe in the conservative cause, we better reject that kind of approach. I don't care why the motivation is that people are appealed, that find him interesting. He's not a conservative. And for a conservative party, we need to elect a conservative. And for us to fix the mess in Washington, D.C., we have to apply conservative principles. And I just think that it is wrong to allow this to happen. And everybody's scared of the guy. I'm not. If it's hard to run for president, imagine how hard it is to be president. Someone has to have a backbone, and I do, and I'm going to stick with this. Not because it's entertaining. Trust me, this is not as entertaining as it might look. Because it's the right thing to do. I don't care what the political consequences are. Obviously, everybody else has made some political assessment that's inappropriate to go after the front-running candidate because he'll attack you. My goodness. These causes that we have believed in for a long, long time are worth fighting for, and I intend to fight for them. Yeah. Well, it is, yeah. So, look, I have a record, which gives me past his prologue. You can find the consistency of my views as it relates to life from beginning to end. I think, and it is from beginning to end, that we should focus, not just beginning. And as governor, I applied a deeply held belief that this is a gift from God, that life itself is important. And so I was the most pro-life governor, I think, during my time as most pro-life governor in Florida. I defunded Planned Parenthood. We eliminated partial birth abortion. We tried to get parental consent. It was ruled unconstitutional by state courts, so we put in the Constitution parental notification. We're the only state, I believe, still, that funds crisis pregnancy centers directly with state monies, that frees up money so that they can do their Christian mission, which is important. And it has expanded the crisis pregnancy network in our state that I think is really important to do, to give women confronted with this extraordinary choice that they have to make an option, a loving option. We've expanded adoption out of foster care. My record is consistently pro-life. And if you recall the Terri Schiavo matter, I got to act on it as it related to an end-of-life issue as well. We should err on the side of life. Planned Parenthood is the place where more than a third of all abortions take place in this country. They do other things. I got all that. People come to the town hall meetings and talk about a laundry list of things that they do. There should be a respect for women's health issues. There's many fine organizations that provide that don't provide abortion services. I think it should be defunded in Washington, D.C., and we should provide support for women in many other ways that are just as beneficial. That's my view. And it is a consistent view, and I think it's a winning view, frankly. This is not we don't have to play defense on this. We can play offense. That's the loving view. And if it's expressed in the right way, it draws people towards our cause. As it relates to marriage, the Supreme Court has ruled. What they haven't ruled on and what we need to protect is religious freedom and religious conscience. So if a baker says it's against my faith to engage and be part of the preparation of a wedding, I'm not going to do it. There should be protections based on the Bill of Rights of religious conscience. The First Amendment provides protections. It's the first freedom of our country. And anything legislatively that's necessary to validate that basic fundamental right needs to be applied. And I'm supportive of the efforts in Washington, D.C. to provide protection for religious conscience. Believing is not something that you do. I mean, Hillary Clinton actually said something to the effect of, people of faith kind of have to get over it. They'll have every right to pray in their home and go to church and the pews pray, but they can't engage with their faith in the public square. Well, no, that's the whole point. Religious conscience is acting on your faith. It's engaging with people. It's showing consciousness about the suffering around you, to feed the homeless, to help the disabled, to do the things that people are compelled to do because of their faith. That is something that is uniquely special in our country, and it needs to be protected across the board. So here's the difference. If someone comes in that's gay and says, I want to buy a cake, and a baker says no, that's discrimination. If someone comes in and says, I want you to help plan the wedding by making a cake and we can discuss how it's done, and that person based on conscience says no, that action should be protected. And that's what should be done at the federal level to eliminate these discriminatory acts that take place at all across the country. That is a place where I think conservatives need to unite and act. Yeah. Last one. Great question.
And making decisions both domestically and on an international basis.
So this is why experience, maybe not Washington experience, but experience matters, because I got pretty good at this as governor. I learned that talent management is one of the really important things that you do, because stuff happens, to use old bumper sticker. I mean, I would wake up and the first thing I'd do is read the major newspapers, and I'd go, it could be literally, you'd read a headline and go, holy shnikes, that just happened. I mean, literally, there'd be like five things that happened, and some version of that, you know what I mean? I'm G-rated here, man. I'm not going to, yeah, family are, it's only seven. So I learned to identify where problems were and to put people of responsibility that had talents. I understood their talents maybe even before they did. In my case, we had to hire younger people because the pay levels in Tallahassee were so low. So you couldn't get people that are already well established in the private sector, because to move 10 miles south of Georgia from most of the big urban areas of Florida was really hard. So I learned to identify the talents of people, and then I had their back. I was all in. I didn't say the dog ate my homework. I rushed to the challenge. One of the things I found, maybe this is personal, and I apologize if I've personalized this, but I found it really old, really quick, that Barack Obama blamed his predecessor all the time. Well, I don't know if he did last night, I don't remember it, but his impulse is to blame somebody, there's no accountability there. If the Veterans Administration crisis happened, I would not just hire a good person, I would hold him to account, and I would want to know exactly how you're reforming the Department of Veterans Affairs, a monstrosity of 340,000 people that has gotten big-time increases in funding, but veterans aren't getting care. It is disgusting what's going on. If that doesn't anger you, I don't know what would. And so the question is, you have to be hands-on, you have to appoint men and women of talent, you have to empower them, you can't cut them out, you have to have their back. You have to be there to help them. Secondly, there are people in Washington, we need to get back to the notion that if you have subject matter expertise, you're not disqualified. This administration, the first wave of people they hired, there wasn't a single person that had any practical business experience. And the economic crisis was front and center as the main issue. And they appointed academics and political hacks to positions that they had no clue. The idea of creating a venture capital arm inside the Department of Energy to pick winners and losers for the next generation of energy, that worked out really well.
Some guy from Harvard probably was in charge of that program, you know? How about putting people in that understand how to sign the front side of a paycheck? So putting people in these agencies, the alphabet soup of regulatory agencies and direct reports to the president that have success in their own lives, that have a life experience that you could look at and say, these people have a view that will make it possible to reform the things that are broken. And the third thing I would say is we need to depoliticize and shift power away from Washington, D.C. I mean, from the White House. The National Security Council has grown exponentially. We should shift power back away from to the Department of Defense and to the Department of State. Create a team again. Everything shouldn't be political. Everything shouldn't be centralized. Everything is focus group there. Every word uttered is some kind of something. How's this going to play on the cable shows and things? We got to lead. We have to fix these things. So you put people and talent, you decentralize power, you empower them to make these decisions, and you go at it. That's my lesson as governor of the state of Florida. And if you're looking for a place where more changes took place in an 8-year term than any other state in the country, I'll just go through it. We privatized the child welfare system, only state in the country that did it. We moved to a community-based model. I mean, fur was flying. We eliminated career civil service protections. You can fire someone for incompetence in Florida. We reduced the government workforce by 11%. But we had a higher quality workforce. We paid people for a job well done. No other state that I'm aware of. Scott Walker gets credit for his efforts. But I did it before. And I earned, thousands of volunteers, so-called, coming out to try to take me out of my reelection. We eliminated affirmative action in Florida by executive order. We eliminated the discriminatory policy of lowering standards for one group at the expense of another. And we had more African Americans and Hispanics attend our university system in spite of that. In fact, because of it, because we had higher expectations for everybody. And the graduation rates, degree attainment rates have gone up as well. We eliminated it for procurement. Minority-owned businesses had set-asides and preferential pricing at the expense of small businesses and other businesses that were discriminated against. We eliminated that, but we had triple-digit increases in minority-owned businesses because I turned the regulators into marketers. But we eliminated the unfair part of this. No other state can first voucher program, second voucher program, third voucher program. I know how to do this, and I'm fearless when it relates to applying and embracing the conservative cause. I'm fearless, because this is what the greatest joy I get is taking big ideas and converting them into reality and helping people that actually oppose the ideas to begin with. That's how we win, is we create converts. And I left with a 67% approval rating in a purple state as the most conservative governor up till that point in Florida's history. You tell me what kind of leader you want in Washington, D.C. I hope it's me, and I hope you'll participate in the caucuses. God bless you. Thank you.